why don't you tell me a little bit about your life in Afghanistan? How long did you spend there, and what was it like?
Okay, I was born in Afghanistan, in the city of Kabul, and I spent a lot of time there. I went to school, high school, and then the 2 years of university at Kabul University. And then I came to the United States for education.
Okay, and what year was that?
That was 1972.
Okay. So what are some examples of some cultural differences between here and Afghanistan that are really noticeable to you, whether it was when you first came over here or even now, that stand out?
Well, of course, the geography is very different. Our country looks more like New Mexico or Arizona, very desolate mountains, cold. Cold desert climate is what you can think about. And once the winter comes, everything stops and the mountain passes are closed, and it's really hard to travel around. But there, of course, you know, cities are bigger here, and there's a lot of crowds and a lot of pollution and not too many farm animals walking around in the street, so that's, we miss that.
Yeah. The oppression of women. We hear so much about the Taliban and the restrictions imposed on women there that are obviously not all that apparent here. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Taliban group have designated women as their major enemy. And in Afghanistan, they've imprisoned half the population, which consists of women. Women are not allowed to be employed. Women are not allowed to go outside without a blood relative escort. It's difficult for women to do much of anything. And if they demand any rights, they're beaten. They have these religious police force going around beating people up. If you happen not to dress in the way that they want you, and this involves wearing what we call a chadari or a burqa, and some people call it, which is a big piece of cloth with a screen, view screen for your eyes, and you're completely covered and you're supposed to function like that. So if these religious police see, you know, an ankle or an arm sticking out, they come with sticks and beat you up. And I saw this the other day on CNN. They were showing, you know, these big guys ganging up on a bunch of women. But they are tremendously oppressive. Women have no rights. Women are severely abused. And there's no place in the world, I think, that treats women the way they do there.
All right. Now, you talked a lot about the Terrorism and Globalization Conference on Sunday about the history of Afghanistan with Russia and the U.S. Could you talk a little bit about that here?
Okay, to understand all this, you have to understand what the Cold War was all about. It was the United States against the Soviet Union, and the one place where they met in a non-confrontational place was a country called Afghanistan. And for many, many years, because of its non-aligned status, the government of Afghanistan welcomed both Soviets and Americans to come in and, you know, help out with the country. And this was a time when Premier Khrushchev called it a peaceful coexistence. And they found Afghanistan as an example where, you know, the United States and Soviet Union could work together and not fight, but to compete with how best they can help this one country. Now, things change once the king is overthrown in 1973 by his cousin, who had long before been considered a non-friendly entity in the country. In fact, the CIA called him the Red Prince, which is totally inaccurate. You know, he was an aristocrat, he had no communist ties or anything. And the problem with the coup of 1973 was that he was helped by a lot of leftist elements. And that made the situation a little bit more troublesome for the United States. And then the United States started a major destabilization effort to overthrow the government of Afghanistan. Because what they were they thought they were doing was they were unbalancing or changing the balance of power in that region, which, you know, giving the leftists too much power, and then the neutrality or non-alignment of the country would be affected. And this is when they created a whole bunch of very horrible people to act as their agents. One of them is a person by the name of Gulbuddin Hikmat Yar. He was a student at Kabul University. He murdered somebody and then he escaped the police and went into Pakistan. He was recruited there by the CIA to form a movement against that government, and the person in charge was a man named Dawood Khan, so against the Dawood government. This Gulbuddin represented the first wave of fundamentalist opposition to the government. His people used to go around hunting women that they considered as not dressed properly or not behaving properly. And one of their methods was to throw acid at little girls and school children. You know, very vicious group. But anyway, Dawood Khan's government was overthrown a few years later by a leftist military and party coup, which then changed everything for the United States. Because then they figured, you know, this non-alignment is gone. Here's a Soviet-friendly government in the country. And this started a very long 10-year CIA operation costing billions of dollars. Now, some of that was funded through taxpayer money. Another way that the CIA raised money, and they learned this in Laos and later on Nicaragua, was to use drugs, to grow drugs there, sell it, and then have this nice little creative financing of their operations. Now, this is a problem now because much of that drug cultivation and drug trade had been one of the major sources for the Taliban's finances. And they made Afghanistan into the number one opium exporter in the world. And thanks to, you know, the Cold War and CIA and all that stuff. Okay, so now you have this major opposition to the leftist government in Kabul in Afghanistan, which finally involved the invasion or intervention of the Soviet Union into the country. They saw the government not being very stable, and different factions of the party were fighting each other. So the Soviet Union sent in 80,000 troops to try to stabilize the situation. This was in many people's minds something that Zbigniew Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor for Carter, really, really wanted. In fact, some people say that he even provoked or baited the Soviets to come into Afghanistan by showing that this would be, that a Western-friendly fundamentalist government would be dangerous to the Soviets and they had to do something. And Brzezinski celebrated all of this. He said, this is a great way to pay back for Vietnam. And one of the things later on that he was heard saying was that, okay, so we have a fundamentalist government in Afghanistan. Is this better than not defeating the Soviet Union? So he has his own calculations of this. Of course, he wasn't aware at that time of what would happen, and, you know, this whole terror network and the tremendous oppression of the Taliban and all of that. But anyway, this 10-year war cost the Afghan people something like a million and a half lives. Right? There's 5 million refugees scattered all over the world, and this is the largest refugee population right now. In addition to that, there are thousands and thousands of refugees inside the country trying to get out, and in recently arrived in Pakistan and Iran. So this is the legacy of the Cold War. Now, the interesting thing was that the CIA, once they transformed an Afghan resistance against the leftists and the Soviet Union into their own battle, they made it an American proxy war, as they say. They then went around and selected the worst elements in the society. These are, you know, the real fundamentalist groups, the real terroristic personality types that they could find to do the most damage. And what they did, the big mistake, was they at the same time backed seven groups instead of, you know, putting them together and having a unified front like they did with the Contras in Nicaragua. And so what happens once the Soviet Union is forced to leave? 10 years of protracted war was too much for them. They lost about 15,000 dead and many, many casualties without any results. So once the Soviets were gone, these fundamentalist groups supported by the CIA called Mujahideen came and tried to establish control in the capital. Okay, so now we have that old division, right? The old, everybody wants to be in power. So these guys start fighting amongst each other. And that starts a very vicious battle in the capital city, something like 50,000 people dead, the city in ruins. And at the same time, Pakistan and the United States find old Gulbuddin. Remember him we talked about? And they bring him as a third force to bring some order. The problem is that nobody likes him, and he adds to the conflict. At one point, he was even appointed as prime minister of the Mujahideen government, while at the same time, his people were bombarding the capital every night. So it's one of those very strange things. But anyway, Gulbuddin is defeated, and there is a need to form another intervening element, would bring some kind of order that would be friendly to U.S. and Pakistani interests. Okay, now here is where at this time we find the oil and gas part of this problem. The former Soviet republics in Central Asia are now in possession of vast oil and gas reserves. So now the problem is, how do we get that? How does the United States get that without the Soviets getting it, or without the Iranians piping it in through their country? Because, you know, we don't like Iranians either, right? So the plan was to do pipelines through Afghanistan. Okay, but to do that, you know, pipelines are expensive to build and maintain. You need some kind of order. So here is where they find this Taliban group, which were created primarily by Pakistan and the Pakistani military intelligence. And their job was to secure the country, to bring order, and to rule through the use of Islamic-sounding politics and ideology. So, for example, when you say, we will exempt or eliminate the rights of women to work or to go outside or to even use public baths, you create some kind of phony Islamic justification for that, but the real purpose is to eliminate political activity by half the population. So people can't gather together, can't talk, can't complain, and they're boarded up in their homes. One of the decrees of the Taliban was any place where women live, their windows have to be painted so they can't have access to the outside. They justify this in terms of religion, but it's really a way of preventing communication. I think we all know that they also banned all kinds of media, videotaping, access to radios, to TV. They banned music altogether, so music and art and drama or anything, and focusing everybody on just whatever they put out in their newspapers and their particular radio station. You get one channel and that's them. Right? It's a very interesting way of controlling large populations. But anyway, the Taliban come in. Taliban were people who, a lot of them were refugee orphans who were given shelter by these religious schools in Pakistan, practicing a very extreme fundamentalist kind of Islam, which then was infiltrated or affected by the Saudis. And the Saudis have their own very extremist kind of Islam called Wahhabism, which does a lot of the things that the Talibs want. So these people are then grown in these institutions. They know no other reality. They're told that the West is your enemy, that you have to practice your Islam in this fundamentalist way, and that's your goal in life. And these people are willing to die for their beliefs. Okay, so these people come in, and they take over the country because it's in a state of chaos, there's nobody in charge, and they push the Mujahideen government out of Kabul and establish their rule. Some parts of these Mujahideen governments go to the north and establish what they call now a Northern Alliance, which practices a more moderate form of Islam, and women are allowed to work and there's education. And it wasn't much different from how things used to be before all of this happened. So it wasn't that extreme for Afghan society. Now, an interesting other thing happens is that sometime in the 90s, after Osama bin Laden starts his rampage against the United States and Saudi Arabia and Sudan, and he is kicked out of Sudan. He had established residence there. And then the Pakistani ISI, the military intelligence, bring him into Afghanistan, introduce him to the Talibs, to the Taliban, and that's where he finds refuge. Now, Osama bin Laden also has a history in the Afghan wars, because at the time when the United States was looking for help in battling the Soviets, one strategy was to get volunteers from all the Arab Muslim countries. The CIA wanted to transform this into a battle of Islam against godless communism, which then attracted a lot of real extremist fundamentalist types, including bin Laden. And bin Laden is comes from a very rich family, and he comes in here and does a lot of coordination work, establishes connections. His money gives him a lot of status, and he makes a lot of contacts with people with guns and arms and things to do. And he also attracts a lot of the Arab volunteers that come in. Okay, the guy's a very charismatic figure, and he follows a very strict, simplistic Islamic ideology, which the West is the enemy. For example, one of his claims is the United States should not have troops in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a holy land for Muslims, and it should not have foreign troops there. And the problem there is that the Saudi government is a major ally and guardian of oil interests for the United States there. So when the Gulf War broke out, the first action of the U.S. was to protect the Saudi oil fields and to prevent any other destabilization of the oil industry there. That's what the whole Gulf War was all about. But anyway, Osama bin Laden has this background in Afghanistan. So when he comes back later from the Sudan to find refuge because people are looking for him, he finds the Taliban government very, very compatible to his beliefs, to his ideology, and they join together. Now, here is where we have this very unholy trinity or triangle of Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, the Taliban, and Osama bin Laden and his gang. And this is the major force that is doing all kinds of terroristic things around the world right now. Pakistan is also involved in major terroristic activities in Kashmir. In fact, just today or yesterday, they had a car bomb that killed 30 people in Kashmir. They have a dispute with India over whether this area called Kashmir should be Pakistani or should be under Indian rule, mainly because the population is mostly Muslims. But anyway, this very unholy triangle is what is the cause of the problem right now.
That was really complete. All right. So why do you think that up to this point no one has defeated the Afghanis?
Well, here you have to define who the Afghanis are. Mm. The Taliban are not Afghans. Mm. They're a Pakistani invasion force, occupation force. And we have Afghan people fighting them.
Right.
In a war that's been, you know, 5 or 6 years now. Now, if you're talking about historical problems that invaders have had in this place, there are a number of reasons. First, the terrain is very, very difficult. You take a piece of aluminum foil, crumble it up, then open it up again, that's Afghanistan. There's mountains after mountains after mountains and valleys and caves. It's very easy to get lost in that place. So an invasion army gets dispersed, it gets caught in valleys, it gets ambushed. In one of the wars with the British, they lost in one battle 20,000 troops. They got caught in this valley and they couldn't get out. And there was one survivor, a military doctor. The other is that the Afghan people are very independent. They're very individualistic. They don't like to be dominated or told what to do. So they resist any kind of foreign domination. So it's been difficult to subdue them as a people. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be freedom fighters if they think that's the threat to their existence.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what do you think, personally, of the present administration in the U.S. and the move toward war?
Well, one of the problems we've had is that the Taliban have been kept in power because of United States policy in the region. Remember, the Taliban were part of U.S. policy to maintain order there. And for a long time, even before this terroristic activity in New York, the United States still gave its blessings to the Taliban to do something. And no amount of publicity regarding the atrocities that were taking place, the National Organization for Women, the feminist majority, Jay Leno's wife organized all kinds of things showing how these people were oppressing women, human rights problems. None of this fazed the U.S. government because they had strategic political reasons. Even Bin Laden taking refuge there didn't seem to bother them. I think the Clinton administration thought if they could hold him up there, you know, he'd be like under house arrest. But it's the U.S.'s inactions against these people that allowed them to dominate the country. They have no industry, no military, no education, so everything, no fuel, no ammunition, everything comes from outside. It all comes from Pakistan, funding by the Saudis, and it's that kind of a mess. So now, September 11th is a wake-up call. What is all of this? In World War I, when they were using poison gas in open fields, once in a while what would happen, the wind would blow back towards the people who had attacked with the poison gas weapons and kill them. And this was called blowback. It's like spitting into the wind, right? You do something, it comes right back to you. Now, much of what the CIA had done, training these terrorists, creating what they call now Arab Afghans, who are everywhere, you know, doing all kinds of nasty things, these are all creations of a U.S. strategic policy that ignores real problems of people and doesn't care, you know, who they align with as long as some current political strategy is pursued. September 11th is a wake-up call. these are the guys. This Frankenstein we created is now linked up to Osama bin Laden and doing all of these things. So this is the big problem right now. That the weakest link right now is the U.S.'s failure to recognize that Pakistan is the major center of terrorism. You know, bin Laden can have his bedroom in Afghanistan, but his living room is in Pakistan. Pakistan has the resources, the technology, the communications for a terrorist network to operate. And the ISI, this military intelligence, is a government within a government in Pakistan. And they're the people who run most of the daily things in Afghanistan with the Taliban, as do the people of bin Laden. See, bin Laden, some reports, and I think BBC ran a report that it's Osama running the Taliban instead of the other way around. So how are the Taliban going to give him up? He has an armed force of many thousand of his Arab friends surrounding him. And so it's going to be really, really difficult to dislodge that. What's the remedy? The remedy is not war. It's ending the Afghan war. And how do we do that? We unplug the Taliban. We unplug their resources, their fuel, their ammunition. And once that's done, there is this Northern Alliance recently made an agreement with the former king to create a national unity government that are ready to come in. And these people have been fighting for many, many years. Once the Taliban weaken, then I would predict that they will fold everywhere because they rule by force. There is no support for these people. They rule through fear. And once the dictator is seen weak, then people bolt. And that's the way to have peace there, not through bombing, not through starting another war and creating all kinds of situations.
Okay. What do you think about the misnomer of bombing Afghanistan in hopes of targeting one man?
This is what President Clinton tried to do when he lobbed 72 cruise missiles into Afghanistan and killed a whole bunch of farm animals. He killed a whole bunch of Afghan peasants. He destroyed a few mud brick houses, but he didn't get bin Laden. Now, there have been claims that bin Laden was warned about this attack by the Pakistani intelligence, who are close to the CIA and close to U.S. intelligence. See, this is like getting Al Capone to help you clean up the Chicago gangsters. Right? So this is the weak link in American policy. Pakistan is the place that they really have to focus on. Afghanistan is a sideshow.
Mm-hmm. So, as a teacher in contact with Southeast Asian and Arab students, what have you gathered to be some of their major fears and concerns and feelings about the atmosphere here right now?
Well, one of the problems we have is with the local media and with the national media and how quickly they stereotype things. Right after the attacks, the September 11th attacks, one of the most popular pieces on the TV was this one scene of one corner of one group of people somewhere in Palestine who were cheering. Mm-hmm. We don't know what they were cheering about. And all the commentators say, the Muslims are really happy. Okay. Which I don't know why they would do that. But this is the kind of irresponsible journalism that then leads to crazies to attack anybody who looks Middle Eastern. And right now we've had people being yanked off airplanes because they look Middle Eastern or they had Middle Eastern names. We've had students being beaten up and harassed. We've even had a person from the Sikh religion who isn't even a Muslim, who's even connected to this. But just because he had a beard and a turban, he was killed. So this kind of stereotyping is really, really bad. Now, President Bush has made some effort to try to convey the thing that this is not an anti-Islamic campaign. But it's really difficult because, see, remember, since the Iranian revolution and the hostage taking, people in this country have been conditioned to see the Islamic world as threatening and to equate Islam with terrorism. And then a lot of this has to do with bin Laden also, how he's hijacked the name of Islam in the public media and to do things, and then people say, you know, you're a Muslim, okay, where, you know, what are you going to bomb now? And this is what needs to be really, really addressed. That this is not a war. It should not be a campaign against Muslims. It should be a campaign against people who use violence to promote their political objectives. Now, the other thing is also the Muslim community here has been subjected to an interesting campaign, especially by the Saudis, that they poured in a lot of money to the different mosques to promote their Wahhabism and their extremist Islamic teachings, trying to capture, you know, the mosques and the Islamic faith in that sense. And these people having money would then squash any kind of opposition to what they want to do. So when you see the Taliban come into power in Afghanistan, there's hardly any Islamic opposition to this